This is the word of the Lord in Psalm number 4, verse 1. Psalm 4, verse 1. Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness. Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress. Have mercy upon me and hear my prayer. I would encourage you to read the whole psalm. It's beautiful. It's a psalm of David to the chief musician on Neginoth, it says. And there were many times in David's life when he found himself in distress. We use the word quite a lot. Usually we don't even mention the D-I-S. We just say, I'm under a lot of stress. And the two words are related. Stress is a pressure. It's a load. Distress usually means it's a pressure in a bad way. And just plain stress, if it's too little or too much, can be a distress. David had known distress. We know some of them just from his biography. When he was a young man keeping the sheep of his father Jesse, one time there came a bear to take a lamb out of the flock. And David had to get the lamb back by fighting the bear. Another time a lion came and took a lamb out of the flock. He had to smite the lion in order to save the lamb. I don't know about you, but that would qualify as distress in my life. But what it did was prepare David. As he went forth, he recognized rightly that his ability to fight that bear and that lion and his safety in emerging successfully from the confrontations was God's keeping. And I hope I would be wise enough to admit the same thing. If I tangled with a bear and lived to tell about it, I hope I would have enough sense to thank God for saving me in that instance. And when you say saving, you realize what I mean. It doesn't mean from saving from eternal woe unto heaven. It means saving my skin from the bear. And that's very much a time-oriented salvation there. David used those experiences, and when Goliath was threatening the armies of Israel and defying them, then he decided to take up the challenge and fight Goliath. And when they objected to him being the representative of Israel, they said, you're just a youth. And he's a man of war from his youth. And he told the story of the lion and the bear and concluded rightly, the God that delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear shall deliver me from this Philistine. And so he did. Yet that wasn't the end of David's woes, because when he was such a hero, having defeated Goliath, he was made the captain of 1,000 in the armies of Israel, and he had the responsibility of 1,000 men in a dangerous situation. Furthermore, Saul grew very jealous of his popularity and at first tried to kill him in more clandestine ways, and then later on just abandoned all pretense and was openly trying to have David assassinated or captured. So David went as a fugitive. At one time it got so bad that he escaped into the land of the Philistines, and they recognized who he was. And so in order to escape out of the land of the Philistines, he had to pretend to be mentally deranged, and he clawed on the doors with his fingernails and let his spittle run down into his beard until they threw him out of the land of the Philistines. Then he hid in caves, and about 600 men came to join him. Then he was responsible for the feeding and shelter of 600 men in the middle of the wilderness while avoiding capture by the armies of Israel. So this was just his young life. If you read in his middle years and older years, it really got harder. So I think you can understand that when he said, when I was in distress, It was more than just an expression, a Bible expression, more than just a word chosen. Brother Fred mentioned in his prayer, and I appreciate the humble and fervent prayers that have been offered, about the King James Version. In my studies, I find it to be the best of the commonly used English translations. I haven't found error in it. There are many English translations of the Bible. Don't object to you owning and studying them at all. Some of them make interesting commentaries. But when I look to the Bible for authority, I use King James too, and I'll tell you why. It's because it is the only commonly used English translation translated from the Masoretic Hebrew and the Byzantine Greek used in the church throughout the ages. All of the others were translated from different, particularly New Testament, originals that weren't used, and I expect they weren't used for good reason. When you begin looking through some of the particulars of the other translations, you can find places where there's contradictions or whether it ascribes weakness or evil to God. It doesn't have the consistency or the historicity or the beauty of the King James Version. I heartily encourage you that if you are one for whom English is the primary language, use the King James Bible. If you're a Spanish or a French speaker or a Chinese or Russian, another translation. But if you're an English speaker, this is the one to go to for an authority. Distress was an accurate word here, wasn't it? David knew what distress meant. And so he's begging for God to hear him. Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness. Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress. Have mercy upon me and hear my prayer. In times of distress, when you call upon God, God does according to his pleasure, as he always does, according to his righteous character. And there's things that he can do in answer to that prayer. One of the things is he can make the distress go away. You ever had that happen in your life? You got all worried and you were distressed and you were just in trembling and you prayed to God and then a little later you got some more news and the problem was gone. I don't know if you've ever had that happen, but that's happened to me, is he just removed the distress. But it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes he leaves the distress present and he changes you. And that's what David is remarking on here. He didn't necessarily remove the distress that David was mentioning. He changed David. David was somewhat different in the process of enduring this distress. Do you see what the change was? Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness. Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress. God is able to make the distress go away or make it smaller than you are, or he's able to make you bigger than the distress. Let's not tell God what he has to do in order to answer our prayers. Let's just bring him our needs and see what he does. Let me give an example. This is the example that made me think of this verse. And you've heard this before, this little lesson. But I want you to look at two instances in the life of the man Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. So he's the individual from whom the nation of Israel sprung. When we think of the nation of Israel today and all its controversy in the world and read the rich history here in the Bible, it all came from one guy. His name was Jacob, and God changed his name to Israel. And I want you to read Jacob's prayer, or Jacob's comments about God when he was a young man, and then Jacob's prayer to God when he was older. And let's see what happened to him between one conversation about God and the next one, and the years that went between. First one that I'd like to read is in Genesis chapter 28. Jacob's a young man at this point. He's going from the land of Canaan up to the north to the land of Haran. The reason he's doing this is because his mother and dad have asked him to leave and go up there. It's not that they're tired of him. It's that his brother Esau, twin brother Esau, is plotting his murder. I don't know if Jacob is aware of this or not, but his mother is. And she wants him to go up to her family's home and find him a wife that's not a Canaanite, but one that's more closely related to her and her family. And that means to the dad's family too, because they were cousins themselves. And so she's wanting him to marry somebody that's in the family. Now, I'm not talking about a sister or anything like this, but she's wanting a distant cousin for a bride for Jacob. And so he's on his way from Canaan to Haran, and he stops in the wilderness to rest. So Genesis 28, let me start with verse 10. And Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he lighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, thy father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. And Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. And he was afraid and said, how dreadful is this place? This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. And Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put for his pillows and set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of that city was called Luz at first. And Jacob vowed a vow. Now here's where I want you to hold his words in your head. He's a young man. He hasn't been a very good man. He has fed his brother by charging his brother Esau his birthright. Wow. And then he's lied to his father in order to get his brother's blessing. He's not a very commendable character, but God loved him just out of grace. He didn't love Jacob because Jacob deserved it. He loved him because he loved him. Nothing to commend Jacob to God, but God loved Jacob. And so God makes this promise to Jacob, and Jacob rises up and says, wow, this was scary. This was dreadful. This is the house of God. And then he vows a vow. Listen to his vow. Verse 20. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. There's some good things about this vow, isn't there? He recognizes that anything he gives, as far as the tenth from God, comes from God. Whatever you give me, I'm giving back 10%. So there's something good in the recognition that what he gives actually was first given to him of God. But look at the conditions he lays on the Lord in order for the Lord to be his God. Now, that means he'll take this Lord that he recognizes and spoke as his God, the one he worships, if the Lord will do some things. Look at the ifs. It's kind of a deal. His vow amounts to a bargain. And Jacob vowed a vow saying, if God will be with me, okay, first, God's got to be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go. Got to keep me in the way that I'm going. And will give me bread to eat. He's got to feed me. And raiment to put on. He's got to clothe me. So that I come again to my father's house in peace. I need to make it back home. Then will the Lord be my God. What do you think about that? He just struck a deal sort of in his vow. Lord, if you'll be with me and you'll keep me and you'll feed me and you'll clothe me and you'll get me back to daddy's house, then you'll be my God. Now, I expect many of us have made a similar prayer. Have you ever done that in a time when you just, anything, Lord, just if I'll do anything, if you'll just get me out of this? I expect that's a fairly common human experience. It's the experience of a child of God who needs to grow up a little bit in the ways of the Lord. When you start striking deals with God, the first thing that you're assuming is you've got something God wants. And you know, the truth of the matter is we don't. We don't. You're assuming that somehow or other he needs your worship. And he doesn't. You got to come at it from a different basis when you grow up in the service of the Lord, realizing you don't have anything he wants or needs. He doesn't need your worship. You've got to come at it from the direction that he loves you out of his own character and that he keeps his own word. That is, your prayer needs to be based on what's in him and not what's in you, except for the fact the desire certainly comes from you, doesn't it? The need is yours. The power and the truth is his. So let's just quickly talk about Jacob's life from this point. He makes it up to Haran, falls head over heels in love with his cousin Rachel. She's just beautiful. And he tells his uncle Laban, "I'll work for 7 years for you for nothing except the permission to marry Rachel." His uncle says, "Sounds good, get to work." And so he starts working. He works 7 years, and after 7 years he says, "Time for that wedding." So they throw a big wedding, and I never have figured out how this worked. But when he woke up the next morning, it wasn't Rachel, it was her sister Leah he was married to. And he went and he said to his uncle, "What have you done?" And his uncle says, "This is the way it's done in our country. The older sister has to get married first." And you know, this was just fair turnaround to Jacob, because remember, his dad was going to bless his brother Esau with the blessing, and Jacob jumped in ahead when his dad was blind and lied to him in order to get the blessing. So here it is when he's thinking he's going to marry the younger sister, and for some reason or other, he's in a blind situation. His uncle slips in the other sister, and lo and behold, he's married to Leah. And his uncle says, "It's no big deal. You just work another 7 years, you can have Rachel." And so he says, "Okay." So he ends up working 14 years for just two wives. And then after that, he's ready to go, and his uncle says, "No, I would like you to stick around, because the income really has been nice with you running things." And Jacob said, "I got to kind of look after my own bank account here, so I need to take some other steps." And his uncle says, "Well, you name the deal." And Jacob says, "I don't want you to give me anything." He had already learned that his uncle was not real trustworthy in contracts. So he says, "So here's the way that I want to set up, so that God, it'll be clear that God prospers me. I'll keep your sheep. And from now on, any of the sheep that are solid colors, which, you know, most of them are, they're yours. But anyone that comes out ring-straked or striped or grizzled, that is, they're all blotchy color, they're mine." And his uncle said, "Wow, that sounds like a great deal. Okay." And as Jacob did that, the sheep, the stronger sheep, began to bring forth all of these blotchy, spotted, ring-straked, grizzled sheep. And by, most of the flock, the stronger portion, the greater portion of the wealth, belonged to Jacob under the terms of that contract. And his uncle's other sons, his guy cousins, started looking at him funny, like, "What have you done to take away all our inheritance? You've been doing all the work, but we thought we'd inherit the wealth. And now, however you've done it, you've made it come so you're getting it all." And they started looking at him kind of mean. And Jacob thought, "I better leave." By this time, He had 12 sons and a daughter. No, I take it back. One of the sons wasn't born yet. He had 11 sons and a daughter. And so he makes a quick getaway during the night while his uncle's off in another place. And the uncle hears and chases after him. And the Lord protects Jacob by speaking to the uncle, saying, "You better leave Jacob alone because he's under my protection." So they make a pact, another contract, and Jacob goes on peaceably. And here he is. He's got his two wives and their two handmaidens, and he's got 11 sons, some of whom are little, and he's got a daughter, and he's got all these flocks and herds, and he's going out. And then as he gets toward closer to Canaan, he gets some bad news. And I want to read about that in Genesis chapter 32. Genesis 32. And I want to start reading in verse 6. "And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, 'We came to thy brother Esau, and also he cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him.' Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed." It's like David. He was greatly afraid and distressed. "And he divided the people that was with him, and the flocks and herds and the camels into two bands, and said, 'If Esau come to the one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape.' And Jacob said, 'O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord which saidest unto me, Return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. For I fear him, lest he will come and smite me, and the mother with the children. And thou saidest, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude." Can you see this as the prayer of a more mature man? And I don't mean just mature in years. I mean mature in experience with God. What had happened in the intervening years? Well, in those intervening years, he had been tricked a couple of times by his uncle, who in many ways was a shrewder dealer than he was. He had been a husband and dealt with family conflict. He had been a father. He had been a businessman and a shepherd. He had done all these things, but I'm going to submit to you that all this experience as nephew and as husband and as father and as earning a living wasn't as key to his maturity as the time with God. Keeping his peace and going on and trusting in God to provide for him and keep him in all of these times he was cheated, in the times when he was working, in the time when he was hoping for peace in his family, in all of these times he was trusting in God. And now the Lord tells him to go back, and he goes back, and God protects him from Laban. But he sends messages. He's coming toward Canaan, and back comes the messenger saying, "Your brother Esau's coming out to meet you. He's bringing 400 men." Imagine the mismatch in these two crowds. Here's Jacob and four women and 12 children and a bunch of sheep and goats and things. Here's Esau with 400 men riding out to meet him. The implication's clear. The purpose would be easy to guess. And Jacob's worried. So he splits up the group that he has into two different groups, hoping that if one group is destroyed by Esau and he stops to take the spoil and stuff, the other can somehow escape, even if he's not in the group that escapes. And after he divides them up and he's wondering what's going to happen, now he begins to pray. Notice it doesn't say he vowed a vow. He's not making vows. He's not making deals with God. He's not bargaining with the Lord. He's begging the Lord. And he's not offering that God, that the Lord would be his God. He's not doing any of those things. He's not putting any conditions on God. You don't read the word if in this prayer. You know, there was a lot of ifs in that chapter 28 prayer. If the Lord will keep me in the way I go, if he will be with me, if he will feed me, if he will give me raiment so that I come back to my Father's house in peace, then the Lord will be my God. Lots of ifs in that, wasn't there? You don't find an if in this prayer. Listen to the prayer. O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac. The issue here in this prayer is not if you'll do this, then you'll be my God. I recognize that you are God to more than me. You are my dad's God. You are my granddad's God. This is approaching and realizing he is the God. The Lord which saidest unto me, you've dealt with me personally, Lord. Return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. The reason I'm making this trip in the first place is because you bade me to do it. I'm trying to be obedient. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. Lord, I didn't deserve to be spared from Laban. I didn't deserve to be spared in my trip to see Laban. Lord, I didn't deserve to have these sheep and cattle. Didn't deserve to have these wives. Didn't deserve to have this life. Didn't deserve to have this health. Or of all the truth, I didn't deserve to see that wonderful thing where the ladder was there going to heaven and the angels up and down and you speaking to me and saying you would bless me. I didn't deserve the mercies. I didn't deserve the truth. I'm not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. That is, and here's my current situation. I crossed the river Jordan. I'm heading back to Canaan, and I've divided my company into two parts. The Lord knew why. He said, deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother. Notice this is not a, if you will deliver me, then I will serve you. If you'll, he's just asking, he's just begging. You know, a beggar doesn't come to you and say, if you will give me $10 for a meal, then I will do something or other. If he's just asking, would you have mercy on me and feed me? So here he's saying, deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him. He's not trying to act all brave before God, as if God would be faked out, thinking here's a man of great courage when he was really scared. He's being honest and open with God. I'm scared, Lord, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. So not only will he kill me, he's liable to kill my entire household, the women and all my little ones. And thou saidest, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Lord, I remember that promise. You said that you would take my descendants and make them like the sand of the seashore, and that in my seed would all the families of the earth be blessed. How will that come to pass if Esau kills all my kids? And so he's appealing to God's promise. When God had promised to make all the earth blessed in his descendants, he's saying, my descendants are in danger, Lord. Please deliver us. That's the end of the prayer. There's no ifs. There's no deals. There's no bargain. There's no holding out his worship as if God needs it. There's none of that. There's just recalling God's promise and asking God's mercy and recognizing God's power. That's all there is to it. And notice what he said. Then Jacob was greatly afraid, or what the Bible said, and then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. This goes right along with what David said. Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress. It looks like over the years that God's grace and the things Jacob encountered, and even that present moment, had enlarged Jacob. It had enlarged him so that he understood more of the character of God. Now, before I sit down, I'll read a short section here in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. And Paul is talking about stress. And he's talking about what the answer is. He says in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, starting with verse 8, "For we would not, brethren, have you ignorant of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were pressed out of measure, above strength, insomuch that we despaired even of life. But we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God which raiseth the dead, who delivered us from so great a death, and doth deliver, in whom we trust that he will yet deliver us, ye also helping together by prayer for us, that for the gift bestowed upon us by the means of many persons, thanks may be given by many on our behalf." He's saying to the church here, I don't want you to be ignorant of the time of my trouble. I don't want you to think I'm a guy that never encounters trouble. I don't want you to think I'm some Superman that can handle troubles that are so great that you wouldn't understand them. I don't want you to be ignorant that when I went through Turkey, that's what they called Asia, that my distress was so great that I was pressed out of measure, above strength, and I thought I was going to die. And yet, I had the reply to that situation that I shouldn't trust in myself, but trust in the God that raises the dead. And that's what it comes to when you find yourself in times of great stress, in times of great distress. There's one that you need to be able to trust in. That's what David said, "Hear me, O God, when I call. Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress." And that's what Jacob was calling. That's what Paul was calling on. And it's now we know something else. Jacob said he was not worthy of the mercies, the least of the mercies, or of all the truth that was showed to him. We have been shown a truth that not only is God a God of promise and of greatness and power who deals with his children personally, but we're talking about a God who raises the dead. And we have it historically denoted in so many ways that Jesus of Nazareth truly was a historical figure. That he was called of Nazareth, even though other sources reveal that he was born in Bethlehem. That he lived in the time of Caesar Augustus and Tiberius Augustus. That he went about, and his life is spoken of in other sources in addition to the Bible. And then we have the fulfillment of so many prophecies, how he was born of the tribe of Judah in the town of Bethlehem, how he was born of a virgin according to the prophecies in the Bible, how he was arrested in such a way that he was crucified with the unjust and made his grave there with the wicked. And it mentions how they would look upon him whom they had pierced. And they even, in Psalm 22, what he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me, is recorded before he said it. And then we have, they gambled, they cast lots for my garments, which they did as the Lord Jesus Christ was being crucified. Evidence after evidence after evidence that he was the one to fulfill these Old Testament prophecies hundreds of years before he ever came to the earth. And then we read in the gospel that not only did he die in the manner prophesied, but he rose from the dead and was seen over and over again by trustworthy witnesses who were willing to go to their own deaths for what they had seen. You know what this tells us about God? He raises the dead. And the Apostle Paul says, I had this sentence, this answer in myself, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God that raiseth the dead. In times of distress, go to the Lord that raises the dead. He may make your distress small, or he may enlarge you, thus making you somewhat more like our Lord Jesus. May God bless you.